time now for the nationally syndicated radio show, The World of Lori Zook. And now, here she is, the smart, the sexy, the savvy, Divine Miss C.
And welcome to the show. Now, every once in a while, when reading Facebook, I come across something that really interests me because it's very heartwarming. And I think there are people out there who do extraordinary things. And I've been fortunate enough to come across somebody who I read about in this article. His name is Kevin Adler, and he has a nonprofit called Miracle Messages. And we're going to talk about that today because it just gives me chills to even think about what these people are doing. So, Kevin, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Well, tell us about Miracle Messages. You know, what is it? Who founded it? What are your backgrounds?
Sure. So about 2 years ago, I actually quit my job and started Miracle Messages. My uncle Mark had been homeless for about 30 years, suffered from schizophrenia. But I never saw him as a homeless man any more than someone would see you or me as housed people. And so about 2 years ago, I started a series of conversations with homeless individuals in San Francisco, where I was living at the time, and just listening over and over again to what are some of the reasons they ended up homeless, hearing their stories. And over again, I heard the same refrain, which was, I never realized I was homeless when I lost my housing, only when I lost my family and friends that provided with support. And to me, this was it made a lot of sense, but it was something that I hadn't heard articulated before. You know, homeless individuals disconnected from their families and homeless as a result of some of that loss of social support. And so I took a walk down Market Street, Christmas time, 2014, and asked every homeless person I met if they'd like to leave a holiday message for a family member or a friend, and I would attempt to deliver it for Christmas. I met a man named Jeffrey, who said he hadn't seen his family in 22 years. And he took me up on my offer. He recorded a short video to his niece and nephew, Josh and Rachel, and his sister. And so that night, I went home and had this video on my phone. Really didn't know what to do with it at that point. But I remember that he had mentioned a small town in Pennsylvania where he's from. And so I go on Facebook and find a Facebook group connected to his hometown. And send them the message and ask if they'd be willing to post it and maybe share a little info on Jeffrey in the hope that we could find his sister. And within an hour of that video being posted, it was shared hundreds of times, liked thousands of times. Friends from high school, classmates, neighbors commented. They said, this is my friend. This is my long-lost classmate. I miss him. How can I help? And in the first 20 minutes of the post, his sister was tagged. I found out a few days later when I spoke to his sister, Jennifer, that he had been a missing person for 12 years, and they had not heard from him in over 22 years. So that's where something awoken in me, Lori, that the power of social media for social good can be incredible. And so I started Miracle Messages, and Miracle Messages uses short videos, social media, and a global network of volunteers all across the world to reunite homeless people with their long-lost loved ones.
Yeah, I think what you do with social media is terrific because you're actually doing it as a philanthropist, you know, as a good deed doer to try to help others. You know, a lot of times I scroll through Facebook at night and I go, what is all this stuff? People are posting selfies and, you know, sayings and all these other things. And I go, ridiculous. If you spent all, I think the average person spends about 45 minutes a day on Facebook. If you spent that 45 minutes a day on Facebook actually doing something to help others, the entire world would change. And so I think that's what you're doing. Where does Miracle Messages operate out of?
So we've been based in San Francisco. Right now, it's myself and my director of programs, Jessica Day. We both quit our jobs to do this full time. And then we have a network of volunteers really all across the world, but mostly in San Francisco and some of the larger cities in the U.S. Currently, I'm based in New York City. I was recently accepted into the TED residency program through TED Talks. And I'll actually be giving a TED Talk in December on this work. So I'm currently based in New York.
Okay. And I'm originally from the New Jersey, New York City area. Tell me what TED Talks are. I'm not familiar with that.
So TED Talks are the yearly event, the main stage called TED, where they bring together some of the greatest thinkers, innovators, scientists to share in, 18-minute or less talks some of their work and some of their key findings. They've developed a system of TEDx talks so that there's local TED Talks in people's communities. They can organize a, TEDx Baton Rouge. And it's really a place where thought leaders come together, share ideas that can change the world.
Now, let me ask you, how has your life changed as a result of doing this? Heavy question.
Changed dramatically, Yeah, I started this work really on a bit of a whim. I mean, it was an area that felt aligned values and what I thought I could bring into the world. But I wasn't sure what was going to happen, and it wasn't fully articulated yet. It was a big leap of faith. There's been times of isolation, struggle. I have seen, kind of experienced bouts of loneliness, just because it can be very isolating work. But what really buoys me through it, Lori, is having conversations with so many people who are experiencing homelessness, who have seemed to have lost so much, and yet still have such an optimism and a verve for life and the desire to reconnect to family members and friends. And then seeing those reunions result in tangible changes and positive influence in their lives. We've found that 40% of reunions have led to stable housing or living with family. And 90% of the messages that we've delivered are positively received by the loved ones. So that's really kept me going. And, I'm in New York now, a city that I've always wanted to spend some time in, and it feels like a new home. I'm a new New Yorker, and I'm brimming. Every morning I wake up, I give New York a hug, and it gives me a kiss or two. That's how I feel. So.
Yeah. It's the city that never sleeps, the Big Apple, and there's always something to do, and you're in the right place for homeless people. I mean, that's one of the biggest areas for homeless people. Also, where I am in Florida now, same thing. A lot of people lost their homes during the housing crisis. Now, do you find, people that have lost their homes, how do they end up disconnected from their family? Is it because they've lost everything and now they're on the street and they don't have a cell phone and there's no way to contact? Or do they feel embarrassed? How does that disconnect happen?
Yeah, all of the above. So we've seen folks who, they lose a job and then they move, they lose the contact information. Some folks who, spend time in prison. Maybe there's a drug-related offense. Maybe it's just 10 years has passed. And like you said, when so much time has passed, it's nerve-wracking to reach out, after all these years, not knowing how they're going to receive you. Maybe there was a falling out with one family member, one brother you don't get along with so well. But then the rest of the family, how do you navigate around that relationship to reconnect with the rest of them? So it's all too human, the experiences, of family disconnection. But, we believe at Miracle Messages that everyone is someone, somebody, and nobody should be defined by what they lack. And that we give folks the opportunity to record short video postcards to their family members saying whatever they want to say. I love you. I miss you. I want to share this. This is on my, on my heart. And then the family and the loved ones have the opportunity to respond however they'd like to, and we respect that.
So then when if that happens, then your volunteers go back and find that person and give them the message.
Right. So we work with local homeless service providers. We have a growing network of right now about 70 different nonprofit organizations all across the U.S. that have basically said, hey, we do a great job with shelter, we have meal programs, we have clothing drives, but what you're doing is incredibly valuable and we really don't have the bandwidth or it's not in one of our funding streams. So can you help us? And so we're developing a global system of local chapters where people in their own community, you know, maybe some folks who are listening to your program right now, Lori, say, hey, you know, I see, you know, this gentleman, this woman with her child every day while I'm walking to work, have a conversation, and they say hi. I'd love to be able to offer this to them, or I'd love to go down and instead of just handing out a ladle of soup, to be able to ask someone, you know, do you have any family or friends that you'd like to reconnect with? So it's really, if we're going to get to our goal, which is 1 million reunions by 2021 all across the world, that's 1% of the world's homeless population, so mm-hmm. 1 million people, we're going to need people all across the world to start this in their own communities, to start local chapters, and to get in touch with us, you know, through either Facebook or our website, miraclemessages.org.
Yeah, what I see you doing, I'm getting chills just thinking about it. It's amazing to me because most people, I think, you know, they see somebody homeless, especially down here in Florida. There are homeless people begging on the street at the street corners, and most people just drive by or you know don't do anything to help. And you know, in reality, you have to sit here and say, you know what, that could be me. And I could something terrible could happen, and I could end up totally disconnected from my family and friends, whatever the situation is. And that could be me, and that gives me compassion for people like that. You know, I'm one of the people that tends to give money to people in situations like that because I feel bad, and I go, that could be me. You're not above other people. But what I admire about what you're doing is you, in helping these people connect back to their family, and a lot of times it sounds like they're actually getting back to their family, is you're helping people get off the street and get back to you know, more of a normal life and have a second chance at life.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think you make a really wonderful point, Lauren. What did they say in the intro? Smart and sassy and savvy. Like, right. I see it now. You made a really good point, which is that, you know, one of the problems here is how we see people in the first place. Right. If you see someone as homeless Joe or homeless Jane, you're thinking, okay, well, I can't give them housing. So, you know, what do? Give them money? Like, I can't really solve their problem. And it creates a disconnect between you and that person.
Right.
Just the next time you walk down the street, imagine seeing that person instead of homeless Joe or Jane as, you know, Kevin's uncle or Lori's brother or, you know, friend. Like, it's seeing
they're
them
human
as
beings.
Someone, somebody. It totally changes the interaction and how you think about that person. And then you interact with them as a person. You say, how's your day going? How long have you lived here? Is your family in this area? When was the last time you've seen your family? Would you like to reconnect to them? Can I help? You know what I mean? It just kind of follows from that. It's people being people, neighbors being neighbors, instead of us trying to serve this human being as a homeless person.
Right, and you're doing it on social media. I'm thinking you should be doing a weekly TV show, you know, where you could feature a bunch of these clips and you would have even more hits because, I mean, the best part of it, the heartwarming part, is when you do make the connection. It's got to be hard when you can't find a connection. As far as getting volunteers and donations, how do you do that?
To get volunteers?
Yeah, volunteers and donations.
Yeah, so... we recently had a video that got picked up by a couple websites and got a lot of traction. It was a media company called Now This did a video on us. So we're at about 20 million views for that video. It was shared about 300,000 times. About 5,000 people reach out to us wanting to get involved in our organization and start Miracle Messages chapters in their own communities. And so we're currently developing a chapter booklet and a system that would allow people to get started in their own area. So right now we're working with those individuals, finding chapter leads, identifying local nonprofits that can support the chapters. And then in terms of donations, we are just starting a crowdfunding campaign to raise $100,000. People can go to give.miraclemessages.org. give.miraclemessages.org and learn more about that campaign, and that's going to go to developing the chapter system.
Okay, now, approaching homeless people, so when you have volunteers do this, do you actually train them, or are they just on their own going up to people that they see?
Yeah, absolutely. And we really, for the first few months of a volunteer's involvement, we don't encourage them to approach
folks on the streets, not because those individuals are, you know, less needy or less deserving of this, or but it's really just, you know, getting to know the process. So we always refer them to local nonprofits. They can go to, you know, a meal service, a ministry program, a shelter, make an announcement about this work, you know, connect with each other as neighbors, and then through that nonprofit, have individuals who are interested in learning more or recording messages to their family members or friends. So
gotcha.
That we find to be just a very effective way to go about this work.
And it's probably also safer. And that was a question. I mean, how do you deal with issues of safety and privacy?
In terms of privacy?
Right. Well, in terms of privacy, for the volunteers, I'm assuming they're okay. I mean, being publicly, mm-hmm. you know. But let's talk then about safety. So if they're meeting, meeting, your volunteers meeting somebody for their own safety, it's probably safer to do it at an organization than to do it out on the street, would be my first thought.
Yeah, and I, you know, safety here, you know, it's easy to think of like a homeless person, you know, becoming violent and attacking the person. It's really that, you know, though that has happened, not in our case, but you know, you've heard instances of that. There's violence in our society, right? So it's
right.
less about that and more about, you know, making sure that the individuals that are recording messages are in the best possible position to reconnect to their families. You know, someone who's still very much in the throes of a drug addiction potentially, you know, suffering from schizophrenia but not on any kind of medication, they may not be in a position to offer an informed consent to participate. You know, so we really, you know, my background is not only as a social entrepreneur and working in technology, but also as a sociologist. You know, I was in England for a number of years at Cambridge and spending time there as a graduate student. And so, you know, my professors and advisors would probably, you know, give me a good whacking if I was doing something too cavalier in terms of, you know, human interaction. You really have to make sure people understand the risks, know the responsibilities, set expectations. And so that's time, you know, that we develop. And at the end of the day, there is a lot of discretion. You know, we want to give people the opportunity to exert their agency in saying whether they want to do this or not. But we just want to make sure folks are really well informed about the process, set expectations. And, you know, the other thing I wanted to mention here, a lot of the conversation and work we do focuses on the disconnect between a homeless person and their loved ones. And that's absolutely, you know, one of the focuses. But there's really a second disconnection that's happening.
Okay.
And that's from us as society to that homeless individual, right?
Well, people look down on homeless people, which is sad.
100%. And so, you know, the goal, yes, it would be great if every person wanted to record a message and every message was received positively and every, you know, family reunites with that person and then they live mm-hmm. together or they're, you know, become a family again. That'd be great. That's not realistic. So what we really emphasize to our volunteers and chapters is the value of you connecting to that person as your fellow neighbor, as your fellow human being, and building up a, you know, an interaction, a friendship even, some kind of relationship. So it's really on two fronts. It's us helping homeless individuals reconnect to their families and us as a society reconnecting to our neighbors experiencing homelessness.
How big is the homelessness problem in the United States?
Well, last night, 600,000 of our fellow Americans slept on the streets.
Oh my God.
And any given year, 3.5 million Americans experience homelessness, and about just under half of them are kids. So what we think about as, you know, the person who's on the street corner, panhandling, seems like they're a little bit out of it, yeah, that person may be without housing and may be in need as much as anyone else. But a lot of individuals who experience homelessness look a lot more like you and me. You'd never pick them out of a crowd. They can be very discreet. And so us working with individuals experiencing homelessness, it really is us working with our communities, our families, our friends, our neighbors. It's a huge problem. 1%, over 1% of the population experiencing homelessness every single year in the United States. That's just totally unacceptable.
It is, but does our government do anything about it? I mean, I can tell you I've got a couple of friends that are homeless that I've tried to help, and it breaks my heart. Bad situations.
Absolutely. Well, you know, there's a couple things the government has tried to do, and there's a couple things that hasn't done well. So, a lot of this has happened at city level. So cities are really at the forefront of this problem. They'll pour in, like in case of San Francisco, $240 million a year against homelessness. About $100 million of that is emergency services, and the rest of it is, nonprofits and developing housing and this and that. But it's incredibly costly to have our fellow Americans on the street. It's cost taxpayers around $60,000 to have a person on the streets for a year, compared to about $15,000 to $20,000 to have them in supportive housing for a year. So even if you're just looking at it in terms of the economics, it's a three-factor increase to have someone on the streets. Now, the problem is there's not much of a political will for this issue in terms of the kinds of radical programs and innovation that's needed. Affordable housing, we are way underfunded, way understocked in terms of the affordable housing supply. Chronic homelessness is not just a natural thing of life. It's something that really emerged in the 80s with some of the affordable housing stock being cut, the closure of some of the mental institutions, the war on drugs, and some of the criminalization of, people for fairly minor offenses. And what we have is this system now where individuals are on the street struggling and they don't have a place to go. And to top it off, a lot of them are totally disconnected from their support systems. And so, the government plays a massive role in this, and a lot of the work, a lot of homeless organizations have been willing to do services and to do maintenance rather than to be innovative and to help a person get off the streets. If the work that we do in family reunification, we have to ask, why is every organization not doing this if it's so effective? And a lot of it has to do with where their funding is, how they allocate staff resources. And truly, there's, something that you can call a homelessness industrial complex.
It's too much red tape.
Sorry, go ahead.
It's too much red tape.
Yeah. Too much red tape. Organizations are disincentivized from getting a person off the street. They're funded based on the number of units of service provided. It's just a total mess. And so for me, I'm an entrepreneur. My background is working in Silicon Valley, doing tech startups. I don't care too much for bureaucracy, And so for me, I care about our neighbors. I care about fellow human beings. And if we are doing something that is helping them reconnect to family, let's do it. And it seems like a lot of our, people want to do something to get involved in this issue, just don't know what to do. And we're giving them a way to get involved.
Right. And by helping them, you're also taking them off the street, which then, of course, is less expensive for everyone in the long run. Now, we've only got a couple of minutes, so I just want to ask you quickly, how many people have you reunited so far?
So we've reunited about 20 individuals with their loved ones. Again, about 40% of those reunions have led to stable housing or living with family.
Okay.
And the vision is 1 million reunions by 2021. And so we're early, we're getting started, but we're developing the systems, the chapters, the mobile app, the partnerships with, companies like Zappos, White Pages, Tint, that really are going to propel us forward and allow us to, mobilize the internet to reunite the world.
All right. Now, have you ever been present when people have been, reunited, and what does it feel like?
Oh my gosh. It is just so humbling. Our second person that we recorded a message from is a man named Johnny Dwyer, and he hadn't seen his family in 33 years. He'd been on and off the streets for much of that time. And he recorded a video message through our partner organization, St. Anthony Foundation in San Francisco. Within 3 weeks, all four of his brothers and sisters recorded short video messages, miracle messages, back to Johnny. And then they flew out from across the country with their partners and their kids to reunite with Johnny again for the first time in 33 years. He had been a missing person for 20 years.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm sitting there in the hotel room with my, you know, little smartphone recording the reunion. And Johnny's looking at me, you know, sitting at the edge of the bed with his family all around him, looking me in the eye and saying, thank you for giving me my family back.
I'd be crying just in that kind of a moment.
Yeah.
You know, like pure tears of joy.
This
but
is powerful stuff.
Yeah, very, very. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me today, and hopefully our listeners will step up. Can you please give out your contact information one more time?
Of course, yeah. So our website is miraclemessages.org, miraclemessages.org. Folks can find us also on Facebook, facebook.com/miraclemessages, or just searching Miracle Messages. And then if folks want to get involved and support this work financially, they can go to give.miraclemessages.org or just go to our website and navigate from there.
Got it. Well, thank you very much for joining me. And we're going to go to a quick commercial break. We'll be back in just a moment. And welcome back to the show. Now, I have with me someone I've had several times before, well-known author M.L. Harris. And M.L., thank you for joining me again today. We've talked about some of your books in the past. You've written a lot of fiction books. I was glued to all of those books. But you've also written some nonfiction books. And I want to talk today about one of your books that I just recently read called Understanding Men, What Women Need to Know. And so, you know, interestingly, I've read over the years a number of books like this. And sometimes I go, oh, my God, who wrote this book? It's crazy. Other times I read a book and I go, you know what? This book is pretty good. And your book was really good. On the back cover, it says, learn the secret that men don't want you to know. Learn how to outsmart a man who is trying to outsmart you. Learn how to find and pick a great man. Learn how to vet a man and much, much more. And so I want you to talk about, first, what inspired you to write a book about understanding men?
Well, hi, Laura. Thanks for having me on the show. That's a great question. Well, I have seven daughters, and I don't know how this started, but I kind of became a coach, you know, maybe a surrogate dad to friends of my daughters. And one friend in particular who seemed to just not be getting it, and she had all the reasons and everything going for her to be in a relationship, and it just wasn't working. So I coached her, and this is going back, I would say, 6, 7, 8 years ago. I don't really remember the exact date. And so as I was progressing in helping her and coaching her, she said, you ought to write a book about this. I think you need to put this down in writing because you're a writer. And so I did. That's how that came about.
Okay. Well, talk a little bit about dating and the history of dating, because when I read your book, I went, wow, this guy actually talks about how dating started and how it's changed. And, you know, I really never put it in that context because it was different in different times.
Well, to paraphrase Winston Churchill, he said, those who do not know the history are doomed to repeat it. So I felt like that if we didn't know the history of where here, what got us to where we are now? And the thing that really doomed us and got us here was what happened, in my opinion, in the 60s and the 70s and the revolution and right after World War II, the baby boomer generation is what really projected everything forward to what we have today. Because Your parents are probably baby boomers, or mm-hmm. your grandparents are baby boomers. And so they've had a lot of negative influence on dating and relationships and courtship and marriage and all of that. The 50% divorce rate and so on and so forth was birthed from that generation.
Okay. In your book, you talk about some of the deal breakers for men. So tell us about those deal breakers.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I guess I should preface that by saying that, you know, women have deal breakers. They might not be written down, not be in writing, but they have them. And but we do, too. And I think it's important that your listeners know that the women do the choosing, and I explain that in the book. But men, we also have deal breakers, and our number one deal breaker, guess what it is?
Tell us.
Nagging.
That's it. Yep.
Nagging. Don't do it. We hate it. And being insecure about other women, putting parents and siblings before the relationship. Not saying they're not important, but just, you know, putting them ahead of the relationship. Venting. Men are not really, because we're more left brain, we're not, actually, a woman really is wasting her time to vent with us because we're into the solution problem solving.
Right.
So when they vent with us, we have a solution, we have a problem, they don't want to hear it, they just want to vent. And so I say, go to lunch with a girlfriend.
Right, because women just...
We don't like...
We want to talk about...
Sorry.
Yeah, women... With women, we just want to talk to each other, you know, about what's going on. We're not necessarily looking for the solution. But with men, I've seen this myself, men just want to go, well, why are you telling this if you don't want me to fix it? tell me if you don't want me to fix it.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, don't tell me if you don't want me to fix it.
Yeah, and what I learn a lot from women in the coaching thing, really. I listen a lot, and I'm going to paraphrase what I hear a lot from women. Oh, gosh, thanks a lot for letting me process that. Well, I got to go, bye, you know. And we're not into processing, and we're into what's the problem. Here's the solution. Go try this and come back to see me. We don't like women who are always a victim,
right,
focusing on the problem, running their lives on feelings instead of facts, because that just drives us absolutely crazy. And eye contact with other men, don't do it. Flirting with other men, don't do it. Looking at other men, don't do it. Telling your girlfriend about our personal problems, don't do it. Complaining in general, being negative in general, always wearing makeup drives us crazy. We'd like to have you show up once with a t-shirt and blue jeans,
okay,
dressing too sexy in public, never relaxing, being overweight, not exercising, not looking your best, not hanging out with us, not watching sports with us, not working on the budget, and the last but not least is going shopping just for the sake of going shopping.
I think most women are in trouble on that one then, you know.
Right.
But
right.
But there are definitely differences I see. And, you know, in your book you talk about the difference between sex and love. And now here's a topic that, you know, when I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and my mom really didn't talk about it because her mom really didn't talk about it. But, you know, I think young women think that if they sleep with a man, it means that he loves her. And, you know, I think how many years did it take my friends and I to all realize that's not the case? Men, you know, for women, sex is part of love. It's part of the emotional aspect. Whereas men, they can do it without that. They can just do it almost as a sport.
Well, and I do want to interject here that men, that we're wrong,
okay,
about that. That behavior is a wrong behavior. It's almost like a learned behavior. It might be have some DNA in there, but we're wrong. We need to I have a really close friend who's a clinical psychologist specializing in relationships. We were having lunch one day, and she said, you know, in the bedroom, men need to become more like women, and women need to become more like men. And I thought that was brilliant. But that's after an established relationship. What men have a problem with is connecting emotions with sex because it makes us feel vulnerable. Vulnerable is a four-letter word for us. We hate it because when we feel vulnerable, we feel weak, and we hate feeling weak. It is a feeling that we absolutely despise, and we will run from it like we're in a foot race at the Olympics. And women need to understand that when we feel vulnerable, We need help getting over that hurdle because women experience vulnerability on a daily basis mm-hmm. and can deal with it and are expert at dealing with it.
Well,
so you have to
kind
of coach us and teach us how to deal with that.
And I think that men have to be open more to the emotional aspect of the relationship, because if they are, if they think they're with the right person, then, hey, why not give that person the chance and the opportunity? I mean, to me, you've heard me say before, relationships are about trust, honor, and respect. Aside from love, trust, honor, and respect. And so if you are in a relationship with someone that you love, you have to somewhat be vulnerable in order to make that relationship
trust
work.
Trust is the key word.
Okay.
Trust is the key word. And especially for men, because women are more in the give you the benefit of the doubt thing with trust. And I'll trust you until you prove that I shouldn't trust you. Whereas men, we're more like prove that I can trust you and then I'll trust you. I don't give you the benefit of the doubt. I don't think I can trust you. Prove to me that I can.
That's hard, though.
Trust is vital. And
yeah.
I'm sorry?
That's hard because that's almost like saying guilty before innocent.
It is. But men are stupid when it comes to women. We're absolutely stupid. Take the most brilliant, highest IQ man in the world and heterosexual man, he's absolutely stupid when it comes to women. We have to be trained. And if women will understand, we're like the little puppy dog that you get a new puppy. Oh, it's so sweet. It's so cute. Well, you have to train that dog to behave properly. And how do you do that? You do that by reward and penalty. Men are very goal-oriented, like the little puppy. I want the cookie. I want the cookie. I want the doggy biscuit. Okay, jump through the hoop, and mommy will give you a little doggy biscuit. Jumps through the hoop, and mommy gives it, oh, and the dog wants to lick her and be around her and everything. Men are just like that. We are just like that. We have to have a goal, and that's why women have to be very careful. And I tell later on in the book, never, ever let a man know that you really are deeply in love with him. Just really ration out that four-letter word love. Let him say it. Make him say it. Get him to say it. But, you know, if he says something like, well, I just told you I loved you and you didn't tell me you loved me. Why won't you tell me? Then I tell them, I say, walk over to him, put your arms around him. Kiss him and say, oh, honey, you know I love you, don't you?
Okay.
Okay, so we have to be trained. And then this whole, with men, it's a journey to vulnerability. It's a journey to emotional connection. It's a journey to connect emotions sexually. As a man gets older, he will become, most men, unless they're a narcissist or a megalomaniac, they're going to really get better at that because of life experience. But women have to be patient with us and work with us, and the woman has to know it is a lifetime thing. She's going to be training him from A to Z for his whole life.
Yeah.
Even a number 7 man, which I put in the book, is the epitome of a good man for a mate. It's like the guy that you have.
Yes.
You have a number 7. We've spoken about this.
Right.
But even number 7 men still need training. Because why? Because, like George Carlin said, women are crazy, men are stupid. The reason why women are crazy is because men are stupid. We make you crazy.
Yes, it kind of goes on that hamster wheel, and it never seems to end.
It really does.
Yeah, I'm pretty lucky in that respect. Now, talk to me about the 7 types of men.
Okay, well, you know, there's in my book for men, there's also 7 types of women. And the types are, it's really important to really kind of figure out, well, before you even get to the type, you kind of have to figure out what you want. So that's why it's important to it's a workbook in my work. It is a workbook. And in the workbook pages, it's going to tell you to figure out what you really want. What kind of a man are you looking for? Right?
Right.
So you have to do that. Chapter 7, page 51 in my book, will describe the 7 different types. Here's what they are. The general is number 1. Number 2, the accountant. Number 3, the brainiac. Number 4, the taskmaster. Number 5, the control freak. Number 6, the con artist. And number 7, the man of God. Well, let's go over to number 7 right away. So the verification on that. The number 7 man, it says man of God, This type isn't necessarily a religious man, but think of him more like the perfect man or the closest thing to perfect. He's the type of a man who is sound mentally, spiritually, and emotionally. He doesn't get as freaked out about the emotional connection as most men do.
Right.
He's honest. He's faithful. He's loyal. And most important, and this is the most important thing, and if a woman wants a man that she will be absolutely certain that the relationship will work, she has to find a man that places her needs and the needs of the children above his own.
Right. I would call it.
So he will be more of.
Yeah, I would call it the golden rule man.
Yeah, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. But he does things without an agenda because whereas most, the 1 through 6 other guys, they got an agenda.
Yes, I've dated all of them. I've dated all of them, Michael. You know?
Yeah. In the book it explains each type, but let's just say they all have an agenda. If I do this, I'll be able to get in their pants. You know, whereas the number 7 man, he falls in love with a woman for who she is, not what she is. Now, let's don't kid ourselves. All men are visual, you know, unless we happen to be a blind person, and then the fifth sense is touch and smell. But with most men, we're visual, so our first reaction is to the visual sight of her. We're attracted to her visually, but the number 7 man, he even flirts differently than the 1 through 6. The 1 through 6 man will say, wow, man, you got an amazing butt on you. And that's what I call inappropriate flirting. That's more like an insult, where a number 7 man will go, oh, gosh, I hope you don't mind me saying this, but you have the most beautiful eyes. Or I just love your smile.
More
because
classy.
He's noticing the soul of that woman. And he falls in love with who she is. So when she gets older and gains weight and everything, he's good to go with that because he's in love with her. And
right.
The key word is in love. So your guy's in love with you.
Yes, I'm
and that's what makes it work. That's why he's not going to look at other women. He's not going to cheat on you because out of fear of losing you, he wouldn't even go, oh, no, I got the best. And when you got the best, you don't need the rest.
Right,
and
thank
that's
you.
Their philosophy. That's yeah. their attitude.
And I wish more men were number 7 because you're right. I've dated all in past years all the other 6 types. And as you go through it, I go, oh, my gosh, like what are these people thinking and how are they brought up? And why weren't they brought up in respectful homes where they were taught how to treat women appropriately or properly? I don't know with the younger kids nowadays, but back in growing up for me in the 70s and 80s, oh, my gosh, it was wild. And men were just out for whatever they could get.
Well, we had the baby boomers who were influencing us. And remember, the baby boomer generation, sex,
right.
drugs, and alcohol.
Yep. Too crazy.
Make love, not war. Communal living, sex, multiple sex partners, going through all of that. My dad, for example, God rest his soul, was a misogynist. He didn't even like women. He hung out with guys. He was always the locker room guy, telling the jokes and everything, and disrespectful to my mom. That was my role model.
Right.
His role model was his dad left when he was 10, so we never even had a father role model. So these number 7 men, typically, if you do a history on them, you'll find out they had a great role model, whether it was their father, their uncle, their big brother, or some man showed them, or maybe their preacher showed them the way to go, and they decided, that's what I want to be like.
You know, it's funny. I hope I never have to date again. But if I did, I would want to run a psychological profile, a comprehensive background check on the person. Because nowadays, mm-hmm. people, they just outright lie about who they are and what their motivations are. And, you know, mm-hmm. you could find out that they're married or they're in a relationship. Or
uh-huh.
I mean, I had a friend years back who had a fellow that she thought was in love with her. And when she was finally ready, mm-hmm. you know, to go out with him, she asked me because she doesn't do social media. She's not on the internet. She said, can you check him out on Facebook? And I was mm-hmm. sick because I had to call her back and tell her that he had recently gotten married. And yet he was still he was still calling her.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, that's
I cover. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to step on you
mm-hmm.
there.
No problem.
Well, I cover vetting, VETTING,
yes.
in the book, How to Vet. Women need to become expert at vetting men. And part of the vetting process is the background check. You have Google and Bing, but if it's someone like, for example, me, I've lived in Texas, Arizona, Minnesota, and Florida. So if you're going to do a background check, like, for example, for an arrest record on someone like me, you'd have to go Texas, Arizona, Minnesota, and Florida, not just Florida. And if it's getting real complicated, then the woman needs to invest in a professional private investigator and have them do the background check.
Right. And ML,
I had a woman do a background check on me. She did a background. She had the detective call me and she said, could I have your date of birth? And I said, look, and she told me what she was doing. And I said, how about I just give you my Social Security number, my birth date, and my driver's license number? Would that help you? And she went, you do that? And I went, absolutely. She has children.
Right.
Absolutely.
And
the fact that she's doing that makes me, like, respect her all the more.
Right, but that's because you're an honest person, and there are a lot of people that are not honest. I mean, and there are private...
Then you discard a guy that's
yes.
not willing to do that. If the guy's not willing to give you... When you go... I talk about this in the chapter on vetting. If you ask a guy, and he goes, well, that's a personal question, and I don't want to answer that, then I even tell her what to say. It's like, okay, well, that's fine, and you have every right not to answer it, but by the same token, I'm looking for a life mate. And I want to make sure that I know who I'm getting involved with. So if you're not going to answer the questions, then I'll just thank you for your time and bye.
Right. Now, interestingly...
And that's what you do.
Yeah, interestingly, I've had private investigators on this show before, you know, down here in the mm-hmm. in the Land Lakes area. And they mm-hmm. charge $55 to pull a comprehensive background check on somebody, which is cheap to ensure...
That's really inexpensive.
Yeah, because and it's a long history of everything, and it tells you everything. And rather than, I mean, sure, you can go through public records, but if you don't know what state they were really from or what names they really used, you usually have to have a certain amount of information to get it done. But it's very comprehensive, and that way you can check the person out. But you're right. If you're dating someone, they should almost be willing to pull it on themselves and give it to you and say, here, this is really who I am.
They do.
You can see
they
someone
do,
who's
because,
honest.
I mean, they should, because a credit check needs to be run.
Right.
Especially a lot of women today, they have assets.
Yes.
And I'm coaching one gal who has quite a sizable estate. And so I just told her, I said, look, you're a little different than maybe some of the younger women that are just getting started. You've got to really vet your guy financially, in addition to the sex vetting questions, in addition to the criminal history.
Right.
You've got to vet him financially. And he should be at you have every, because if you'll produce your financial statement, she went, I will. I don't have a problem with that. I said, then he should be able to and willing to present his. And if he's not, then you just check him off the list. Say, thank you. Next.
Next, exactly. And I think when you're older and if you do have assets and you're a woman, you have to beware a lot of these Romeos that present themselves as if they have money, but they don't. But they really want the woman's money once they find out. And that's how they end up married and, you know, and gaining access to that. If you've earned that, I don't think there's anything wrong with two older people who each have their own assets to keep them separately, even if they get married. And then, sure, if one of you predeceases the other, you can leave it to the other in a will. But it's less of an incentive for a con artist to come out after you.
Well, the number six man is the con artist. And the problem with a con artist is they're so believable. It would really be cool if they had tattooed on their forehead, I'm a believable con artist, but they don't.
Right.
And they are so believable because most of them are pathological psychopaths. They believe their own lies. They tell them so often they believe them. And they're so believable, and they know how to manipulate and control. And so they're the ones who will make the woman feel like they're crazy. You're crazy. So women have to really be careful for that. One more thing I want to say about the types of men. Because I had a woman call me on coaching, and she said, well, can a guy be more than one type? Absolutely. She said, well, can the number seven guy be more than one type? I said, absolutely. What you want to make sure with the number seven is that he's not a con artist and he's not a general. What you would like for maybe the number seven to be, if he's going to have another one, is maybe an analytical. Maybe, you know, he's an accountant type.
Right.
And then that way he's going to be really good with the finances. He's going to be really good with with responsibility and having the debts paid, having everything, all the bases covered the way the accountant type does. But typically, the number seven guy, if he has to go out and get two or three jobs to support his family, he will. His family comes first, and he gets his fulfillment in life by taking care of his family, his wife and his children.
One of the things I want to point out, ML2, is that that's worked well for me, is gut instinct. And so in my gut, if in years past when I dated people, and I'm not going to say, I mean, there are times certainly I got fooled, but usually if you start to think like, am I a little crazy? Should I back off a little bit and let him handle the situation? You know, how if I always feel like I have to compromise something, if something is rubbing you the wrong way, that is usually a hint that there is something wrong. And you might not, it might not be obvious, but there's probably a problem. Now, we've got about 1 minute to close. So just tell me quickly, and I know this will be hard to do in 1 minute, but what do men look for in a wife?
What do men look for
in a wife?
Well, it depends on their type, because, like, for example, if it's the general type, the number one guy, he looks for eye candy. So he's looking for eye candy so he can go, look at me, look at what I got. The accountant looks for another left brain woman. I actually have a friend who's left brain married to a left brain. They're both the accountant types.
Okay.
The brainiac is the scary one. He's looking for someone who's weak. Taskmaster, someone who's going to be submissive. The control freak, someone who's submissive. The con artist, the wealthy woman. And the man of God is looking for a number seven woman, which is a homemaker type. You have to read the man's book to find out about that.
Well, that's all right. We're going to cover that on another show. We've got to wrap it up. I want to thank you, ML Harris.
Okay.
Understanding Men, What Women Need to Know. How can you be reached?
Thank you so much.
Yep. How can you be reached?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. The best way to reach me is to go ML Harris author on Facebook.
Great. Thanks again for joining me, ML. I'll have you back on another show. I'll have to read your Understanding Women book. That'll be interesting. So no. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you so much, Lori. Have a great day. Bye.
Thank you. Thanks for joining me, and join us next week on The World of Lori Zook.